I think we're ready to go ahead and start this morning. This is lesson 13 of Precious Remedies Against Satan's Devices. And I'm going to take this last device of chapter 4, device 8, and I will take all but one section of chapter 5. And we'll look at sections 1, 2, and 4 this week, and I thought that would be all that we had time for, and next week we'll take section 3, which is a pretty important topic in chapter 5. It is my hope then that there will be three lectures remaining today and the 10th, I believe, and 17th, and we should be able to finish it, although we won't be able to cover quite all the material. There are, I believe, two appendices in the back we'll give some treatment to, but not all of it. So that should bring us to a close the weekend of Christmas then, and we'll have a break with two different, or we'll have, for 2 weeks, we'll have another topic that we're going to cover. I won't be here. I believe Dr. Noel will handle that, and then we'll resume studies in January of the next class. So let's take a look at device 8 of chapter 4. Remember, the goal that Satan has is to keep the saints in sad, doubting, and questioning and uncomfortable conditions, and he does so in this device by persuading them that their estate is not good, their hearts are not upright, their graces are not sound, because they are so followed, vexed, and tormented with temptations. Now, if Satan cannot get us to succumb to the temptation that he brings our way, if he cannot get us to openly sin, then his next best recourse is to get us to be in a sad, doubting, questioning, and uncomfortable position. And he'll do this by bringing to our mind the fact that we must not be in a good estate or have an inheritance or in a good position because we're being tempted so much. It's really very subtle and clever on his part. Tempt someone, and when they resist the temptation, bombard them with thoughts that they cannot possibly be right with God because, after all, they're being tempted. This is a very subtle device, but a very effective one. And it's well worth remembering that if he can't get us to sin, he's going to get us to at least be discouraged. Well, it is the method of Satan first to weary and vex the soul with temptations and then to tempt the soul, that surely it is not beloved because it is so tempted. And by this stratagem, he keeps many precious souls in these sad, doubting, and mourning tempers many years, as many of the precious sons of Zion have found by woeful experience. Now, I'm not sure what your experience is, but if you have endured a real torment of the soul, it is a very useful device on Satan's behalf to keep you ineffective for the work that God has called you to do. The whole goal is just to keep you sad and doubting. All right, so the first remedy, that those that have been best and most beloved have been most tempted by Satan. This may seem very obvious at first, but it is very helpful to remember that we are not alone in the temptations that we endure. The enmity that Satan has for God must be on a scale, I reckon, beyond our comprehension. Why is he so angry? Why is he so motivated to destroy the lives of the saints? I don't understand why. If he cannot destroy you with temptation, then he will vex you with the act of tempting. Satan's disposition is that of hatred and destruction. And he is our enemy. That's his goal. He has a drive which brings him pleasure on some scale when people are brought to ruin. He is, I wouldn't describe him as happy, but you could say that this is what satisfies him to the capacity he is to be satisfied. The trouble is, we often think that when something is happening, it's happening to us and to us alone in the realm of history. But Peter reminds us in 1 Peter 4, chapter 12, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing is happening to you." Now, Peter makes the point that everybody is going to go through a difficult ordeal. It may not be the exact same set of circumstances as other people, but it is usually centered around the same things. Our souls are put in difficult straits. We find the situation uncomfortable, displeasing. Maybe we're succumbing to temptations. But Peter tells us, don't think it strange when these things happen. Now, why would he write that? It's important to remember that there are two characteristics that I find that generally appear in people's lives when something difficult or strange is happening to them. The first is they believe it's unique. That whatever is happening to me and has happened to no one else ever before. Well, it may be true that no one had the precise circumstances as are being met out by you, are being met to you, but it doesn't mean that those same types of circumstances haven't been met by others. Peter writes that we should not consider it strange because we are all in a common lot. It's very difficult to remember that others have had the same thing happen to them. The second problem that we run into when we incur these strange trials is we believe these things are wrong because they're happening to us. Now, when we look at that, we see, first of all, that our situation's unique. No one has ever endured it. And if we can get past that, we think, well, it's wrong because it shouldn't be happening to me. We share a common lot, and we will endure many, many trials. And you may very well be right. It shouldn't be happening to you. You probably didn't deserve it, at least to some degree. But that doesn't mean others haven't participated in the same set of circumstances. What do we do when the time comes when Satan tempts us like this? Well, we remember, first of all, that God loves us. Remember that He loves us, and He has loved the saints who have gone before in the same manner He loves us. He loves us through Christ. And we can take comfort knowing that those who are now with God, enjoying His presence in heaven, endured the same circumstances, oftentimes worse than we were. There's an old... I don't remember the exact venue. I think it was, it might have been Berkeley, where President Reagan was giving a speech and he was being heckled ceaselessly by the crowd. They were just pounding him. And finally, one heckler stood above the rest and decried Reagan's administration as he was woefully out of touch. And he said, "What do you know about what we have to face in life? You didn't even have air conditioning. You didn't have the electronics that we have, the technology. The gaps between us and you are too much. You cannot relate to us." And Reagan, as only Reagan could do, said, "Well, yes, that's right. We didn't have any of those things, but we invented them for you." And so whenever you think that you're way out on a precipice and no one else has ever endured anything at all, remember that others have thought through the same problems that you're having and have come up with solutions and done things, that you really are not alone. You really are not enduring things that no one else has ever endured. Brooks writes that if these, that is the saints, that were so really, so gloriously, and so eminently beloved of God, if these that have lived in heaven and set their feet upon the stars have been tempted, let no saints judge themselves not to be beloved because they are tempted. The presence of temptation is not an indication that God is displeased with you. It is not an indication that God does not love you anymore. He does love you. And if the saints today enjoy the love of God, and He let them endure serious temptations, do not let the presence and the vexing nature of temptations convince you that God does not love you. Remedy 2. That all the temptations that befall the saints shall be sanctified to them by a hand of love. The next remedy, this remedy here, is helpful in reminding us that what God sends our way is sent by love. Now, that may seem odd to look in the perspective of temptations coming our way, but we must remember that what God sends to us, He sends by a hand of love. God only acts in a loving way toward His people. It's the only way He acts. He never does less than express His love for them. Well, Brooks has an extended quote here that I'd like to read, that I think helps summarizes this section very well. Temptation is God's school, wherein He gives His people the clearest and sweetest discoveries of His love. A school wherein God teaches His people to be more frequent and fervent in duty. When Paul was buffeted, then he prayed thrice, frequently and fervently. A school wherein God teaches His people to be more tender, meek, and compassionate to other poor, tempted souls than ever. A school wherein God teaches His people to see a greater evil in sin than ever, and a greater emptiness in the creature than ever, and a greater need of Christ and free grace than ever. A school wherein God will teach His people that all temptations are but His goldsmiths, by which He will try and refine and make His people more bright and glorious. The issue of all temptations shall be to the good of the saints, as you may see by the temptations that Adam and Eve, Christ and David, Job, Peter, and Paul met with. Those hands of power, of love, that bring light out of darkness, good out of evil, sweet out of bitter, life out of death, heaven out of hell, will bring much sweet and good to His people out of all the temptations that come upon them. There is a design in all that God does. If there's anything that we could have learned from the mystery of providence class that we had, is that God has a design in everything that He does. Everything has a design. The trouble is, we love to censure God's designs. We love to say, that's not the best way to handle me. When a situation arises and we have these vexing circumstances around our soul, we're convinced that anything else would be better than what this is right now. And given enough time, you can prove it to yourself in your own mind. The trouble is, God knows exactly what He's working in our life and in the lives of everyone else around us. And it's not up to us to censure God for the way He bestows His goodness upon His people, which may be a time of being tempted and even having our souls vexed for a while. It will always bring about the good that God desires. Remedy 3, that no temptations do hurt or harm the saints so long as they are resisted by them and prove the greatest afflictions that can befall them. Well, remember, the idea here is that Satan is attempting to vex our soul because of the presence of temptations. And sometimes it can be helpful to take a step back for just a minute and remember exactly who this wily character Satan is. I think it was probably a circumstance which began with some reasonable intentions, but the idea of the caricatures of the devil in times past were probably designed to mock him and not give him the due that he has. And that there's something of virtue in that, mocking the devil. I think it's helpful to understand that he is defeated. But there's a big difference between seeing and understanding him as being defeated and mocked and failing to appreciate his strength and the nature that he has in his the goals that he has. He also is working toward an end, and he is working toward goals. And I'd like, because I think the scriptures, especially in the New Testament, portray a very broad range of ways to describe the character of the devil, that we'll look at a few of these verses. So let's turn to Revelation. We're going to go through these rapidly. Let's turn to Revelation 12:10. The idea here is not to try to scare you with boogeymen, as it were, but to paint an accurate picture as to who it is that we fight. Let's back up to, I didn't write this one down, but verse 9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of Christ have come. For the accuser of the brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. Now, just a couple of things to think about when we see those two verses there. He is called the deceiver, the great dragon there, Satan. He is described as the accuser of the brethren. Now, one of the things that I find interesting is that we feel vexed by the presence of Satan in our society and in our lives when we experience the temptations and the torments he brings. But this particular passage says he accused them, as the people of God, before our God day and night. He has been cast down. Well, think of the long-suffering of God. Think of the long-suffering of God in his infinite wisdom and plan that he suffers the presence of the devil for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. He suffers him because he serves a purpose. He's defeated. He no longer has rule over nations. He no longer has the strength he once possessed. Christ is seen fit to destroy the work of the devil. But think of how odious this creature is in the sight of God. And God will have his day with him, and he will bring him to his complete ruin in the end. But though we are vexed with the presence of Satan, that all of heaven sees what is being accomplished by this useful idiot, and it is helpful for us to remember that he is a fierce enemy. He is an accuser, and he attempts to deceive us. Let's go to 1 Peter. Well, in 1 Peter 5:8, we'll skip this one for reading it. He is called the adversary. He is called the adversary. And let's go to John. Just to save a little time, we'll skip over to John 8. A very helpful verse there. John 8:44. This is Christ who is speaking. You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. Now that ought to scare anyone who thinks the devil is unimportant in life, that he is to be mocked and not taken seriously at all. That here he has offspring. Who are those offspring? Well, they are the people that inhabit the city of men, the people that love to walk in his ways. And he is a liar and the father of all lies. He's also a murderer. He doesn't trifle with the saints. You've seen his goals. He's the deceiver. He's the accuser. He's an adversary. He's a liar. He's a murderer. He is out to get the people of God, and if he can't get them, he will leave them in a sad, doubting, questioning, or uncomfortable position. Let's go to Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4 and in verse 3. Now, when the tempter came to him, that is Christ, he said, "If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread." Here we see that Matthew bears witness that the devil is called the tempter. He is there to tempt. He not only tempted the Lord, he had the audacity to tempt the Lord Jesus Christ, but he will attempt to do so in each of our lives. Let's go over to Matthew 13 in this survey of names. Matthew 13 and verse 19. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away that was sown in his heart. This is he who receives seed by the wayside. So in this great parable of the sower here, the devil is called the wicked one. Why? His intentions are wicked. He seeks to destroy the work of God in the lives of his people. And then let's turn to the Gospel of John again, chapter 10. John 10:10. The thief does not come in except to steal, kill, and destroy. And I have come that they may have life, and that they may have it more abundantly. Christ is using this analogy to describe those who attempt to hurt and ruin the people of God, and called a thief there. Well, what do we do with all these names? We've got a list of characteristics of the devil. It's well worth remembering that he is playing serious business. He means to leave your soul in ruin. If he can't do that, he will make you ineffective. He will try to disable you so that you will be at least in a sad, doubting, and questioning condition. I think even at a cursory glance, it's enough to see that Satan is not stupid. He is a fool, but he is not stupid. He knows what he's doing. He's had a long time to practice his art. He's had a long time to perfect it. Well, I'd like to read three sections from the book that I thought summarized this idea of the protection we enjoy and the remedy that God offers us in our efforts to resist the devil. Make strong and constant resistance against Satan's temptations. Make resistance against temptations by arguments drawn from the honor of God, the love of God, your union and communion with God, and from the blood of Christ, the death of Christ, the kindness of Christ, the intercession of Christ, and the glory of Christ, from the voice of the Spirit, the counsel of the Spirit, the comforts of the Spirit, the presence of the Spirit, the seal of the Spirit, the whisperings of the Spirit, the commands of the Spirit, the assistance of the Spirit, the witness of the Spirit, from the glory of heaven, the excellency of grace, the beauty of holiness, the worth of the soul, and the vileness or bitterness and evil of sin. The least sin being a greater evil than the greatest temptation in the world. What I was hoping I would do with that particular list that Brooks offers is to paint a very broad picture of all the different remedies that we have at our disposal. The honor of God, the intercession of Christ, the excellency of grace, the vileness of sin, and so forth. That the armor that we possess, the tools we have at our disposal, are not few, but many. They are great. We can resist temptation. We need not yield to it every time. We can grow in our resistance. Here's the second quote. And look that you make constant resistance as well as strong resistance. Be constant in arms. Satan will come on with new temptations when old ones are too weak. In a calm, prepare for a storm. The tempter is restless, impudent, and subtle. He will suit his temptations to your constitutions and inclinations. Satan loves to sail with the wind. If your knowledge be weak, he will tempt you with error. If your conscience be tender, he will tempt you to scrupulosity and too much preciseness, as to do nothing but hear, pray, and read. If your consciences be wide and large, he will tempt you to carnal security. If you are bold-spirited, he will tempt you to presumption. If timorous, to desperation. If flexible, to inconstancy. If proud and stiff, to gross folly. Therefore, still fit for fresh assaults, make one victory a step to another. When you have overcome a temptation, take heed of unbending your bow, and look well to it, that your bow be always bent, and that it remains in strength. When you have overcome one temptation, you must be ready to enter the list with another. As distrust in some sense is the mother of safety, so security is the gate of danger. A man had need to fear this most of all, that he fears not at all. If Satan be always roaring, we should be always watching and resisting of him. And certainly he makes strong and constant resistance of Satan's temptation, shall in the end get above his temptations, and for the present is secure enough from being ruined by his temptations. Very helpful to remember that the battle is always on. Now, there is one caveat with that. There is a group there is a school of thought that is arguing Satan is behind all evil and man has no need to fear his own heart and that everything is caused by the devil. And these folks tend to be found in the charismatic churches, the people that would be called the Word of Faith churches. And they're always looking over their shoulder, rebuking the devil for this and rebuking the devil for that. And I have consciously avoided the whole idea of the idea of rebuking the devil in this class for the simple purpose that that it's all too easy to blame other people for our problems. He's out there. He works. But we have far more to fear with ourselves. When Brooks writes that Satan loves to sail with the wind, what he's getting at there is he's very economical in the way he does things. He will design the temptations and the vexings so that they suit you perfectly, which means your own disposition and frame and the way you look at things. So when you resist the temptations that come, when you resist the devil, when you submit yourself to God and you humble yourself to receive His grace, that action does not look like somebody who's walking around rebuking the devil and calling out to the air constantly. Make your request known to God, and the devil will flee from you when he sees he doesn't have a stronghold. And this last, for a close in this section, for a close of this, to remember that it is dangerous to yield to the least sin to be rid of the greatest temptation. To take this course were as if a man should think to wash himself clean in ink, or as if a man should exchange a light cross made of paper for an iron cross, which is heavy, toilsome, and bloody. The least sin set upon the conscience will more wound, vex, and oppress the soul than all the temptations in the world can. Therefore, never yield to the least sin to be rid of the greatest temptation. There is, unfortunately, a real inclination to say, if I just give in, it'll be over. Well, it will be over. That will be over. But then you'll have more problems on your hand that are far worse than any of the temptations that you had to begin with. Okay, we'll take just a minute here to entertain any questions or comments as we close chapter 4 and begin chapter 5. It's a limited time offer. All right. Chapter 5. I don't want to take a lot of time on several of these sections. Section 3 is very helpful, and I want to look at that next week. So we're going to take sections 1, 2, and 4 today, and I would like to finish all of those. And some of these, I think, are just so simple and self-explanatory, we don't need to spend a lot of time there. So chapter 5, Satan's devices to destroy and ensnare all sorts and ranks of men in the world. Section 1, Device 1. His first device to destroy the great and honorable of the earth is by working them to make it their business to seek themselves, to seek how to greaten themselves, to raise themselves, to enrich themselves, and to secure themselves. Now, there are, I think the world of you folks, but I didn't think we needed quite as an extended treatment in this class on the warnings of how Satan attempts to get the great and learned. I don't think you should take that as a diss on your hardworking ethics and character, but I think he has a different target audience in mind. So we will peruse these gently. Does it take a lot of imagination to see how Satan's desire to work in the lives of those who are great on the earth, that they seek to enrich themselves? Does it take any effort at all to believe that this is a common plight of men because men are inclined to want it and Satan is inclined to convince them of it? Take a look at the corruption that we've seen in Congress, the corruption that the state of Oklahoma has seen through its illustrious history. How about at the United Nations, the scandals that went on there? It just doesn't take a lot of effort to envision that there are people out there who seek to enrich themselves. One report that I read recently was critical of university administration across the country and how the salaries of university administrators were skyrocketing. I'm sure the professors here can attest to this, that quietly, of course, that university administration, I don't know what the case is at OSU exactly, but the salaries and such and the perks being lavished upon university administrators, the presidents and chancellors and such, have been growing at a rapid race pace. So it just doesn't take much imagination to see how Satan works in the hearts of people who are in positions of power that they might enrich themselves. Seeing Brooks address this topic so long ago is helpful in reminding us that human nature doesn't change, does it? Satan still desires to corrupt men who are in power. And men still plot in wickedness, and Satan is still active in helping them. So let's look at I want to take all six remedies at once, and I would like to read those. Remedy 1, that self-seeking is a sin that will put men upon a world of sins. upon sins not only against the law of God, the rules of the gospel, but that are against the very laws of nature, that are so much darkened by the fall of man. 2. That self-seeking does exceedingly abase a man. 3. To dwell upon those dreadful curses and woes that are from heaven denounced against self-seekers. And remedy 4. The fourth remedy is that self-seekers are self-losers and self-destroyers. Remedy 5. To dwell much upon the famous examples of those worthy saints that have denied themselves and preferred the public good before their own particular advantage. And remedy 6. That self is a great let to divine things. Therefore, the prophets and apostles were usually carried out of themselves when they had the clearest, choicest, highest, and most glorious visions. Well, let's look at Exodus 18 for an example of what we should expect in rulers. We'll start in verse 17. This idea of self-seeking. Now look here. This is a prime example. The devil does not want us reading the scriptures. He hates the Old Testament. Look at that. Look at that. Right there, before your eyes. You saw it here first, folks. Self-seeking runs completely contrary to the design that God has for leadership. They were here is an example of how the people of God were to choose their leaders. And we'll pick it up in verse 17 as we see Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, giving him some very, very good advice. Let's see, we'll read 17 through 21. So Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good. Both you and the people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out, for this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of ten." Moses should help the people of God by getting other rulers to assist him in the great work that he had. And the qualifications, it's quite interesting, the qualifications for these men, they should be able, means they ought to be able to at least carry out the task that's set before them, but they should fear God. They should be men of truth. And they should hate covetousness. Now, why put covetousness in the list? Being able-bodied, being able to discharge the duties of office, being able to see rightly and judge correctly, those things are all important. Men of truth, that's important. But covetousness? Why worry about covetousness? Because even Jethro could see that there is a real temptation when you're in a position of leadership to seek after yourself and to enrich yourself. Way back here, in Moses' day, he was given good advice that people who hold positions of leadership should hate covetousness. They must have a demonstrated ability of loving that which is right and true. Selfishness will also contort man in such a way as to bring out the very worst. When a man becomes bent on self-seeking, Brooks identified in the opening here how this turns a man into something base and vile. Self-seeking will make a man say anything, do anything, and be anything to please the lusts of others and to get advantages upon others. Self-seeking by the powerful and by those in leadership is particularly onerous because it is a sin which not only vexes the soul, but harms the souls of others as well. It doesn't take much imagination to see the effects of this. So, I've got just a three or four illustrations here. How about men who are self-seeking and use what the larger catechism describes as unjust enclosures, eminent domain, as a way to enrich themselves? Seen this happen time and time again. How about bribes? Self-seeking. Let's enrich ourselves at the expense. There's that Congressman Jefferson, I think his name, from Louisiana, is that right? ended up with $100,000 of tightly wrapped frozen money, put it in his freezer thinking he could escape by enriching himself, had the National Guard go at peril to his house so he could retrieve some money. Isn't that, you guys recall that? Yeah, during the Katrina. So he not only was willing to endanger himself and his name and his soul, but people, others around him. How about the idea of insider trading? What about Enron? It doesn't take long to see how people enrich themselves at the expense of others. Or how about just brute intimidation? You will do this, or else. The authority that people have in government. In all these cases, we see the sins of superiors against inferiors. Satan does a good business here, and he is very successful at duping men to be his pawn all too often. Well, what's a fellow to do about all this? You know, it's easy to sit back and complain that the government's corrupt. Well, that's patently obvious. But Brooks has a very helpful point that he makes. Now, remember, he's in a situation where there's a monarchy. The king was certainly wealthy, but not by the kind of wealth that we're talking about that people have today. The parliament was wealthy, but they could enrich themselves, I think, like many men do today. So my point is, I think the situation is worse in terms of absolute dollars and positions and power and influence than anything Brooks saw. But this was his remedy. His personal practice was to pray that all our rulers may be so spirited by God that they may be willing to be anything, to be nothing, to deny themselves, and to trample their sinful selves under feet in order to the honor of God and a public good, that so neither saints nor heathens may be witnesses against them in that day, wherein their hearts and practices of all the rulers in the world shall be open and bare before him that judges the world in righteousness and judgment. Well, we can pray that God would save these men, that he would help them so that their soul does not come to ruin, which is the course they're on right now. All right, section 1, device 2. By engaging them, that is, these rulers, against the people of the Most High, against those that are his jewels, his pleasant portion, the delight of his eye, and the joy of his heart. I'm not going to spend really any time on this other than to say if there's anything that is true about the history of the Jews as it relates to other governments, it's that when other people were in charge or had captured the Jews, They sought time and time again to go after them, didn't they? To seek to destroy them. You remember the many such occasions that in, most notably under Queen Esther, didn't Haman devise some wicked plots, the pogrom, to expel the Jews? The Russians have attempted to exterminate the Jews on various times. God's people have been persecuted around the world and Darfur, Sudan, Indonesia, by authorities, government authorities. These are people who are out to get them. How about the Jews in the Apostles' Day? Didn't the high priest attempt to put the kibosh on the spreading of the gospel? Paul himself? It doesn't take much to see that when people get in positions of influence, I don't know which comes first, the enriching of themselves or the persecuting of God's people, but it is a common plight that oftentimes those unjust rulers will come after the people of God. Okay, so let's that's enough for that section right now. Section 2, I think this is right, device 1. This is the device listed that Satan has his devices to ensnare and destroy the learned and the wise, and that sometimes by working them to pride themselves in their parts and abilities, and sometimes by drawing them to rest upon their parts and abilities, sometimes by causing them to make light and slight of those that want their parts and abilities, though they excel them in graces, in grace and holiness, and sometimes by drawing them to engage their parts and abilities in those ways and things that make the honor of Christ, the joy of the Spirit, the advancement of the gospel, and the liberty of the saints. That's a big device, but it's you don't have to read much today to see the absolute and utter contempt that many learned men have for Christianity. They just hate Christianity. They hate people like us. And to consider their beliefs to be fundamentalism, thoughtlessness, against reason. It doesn't take much. I'm sure if you're in academic circles, you see these kinds of things even more frequently, but it's certainly available in popular culture when you read columnists or listen to news and spirited debates. Well, the device that that we're thinking about here is not so much just how the wicked handle these situations, but how do those among us who are learned and wise handle this situation? They need to be careful because they are in a position to be a target of attraction. Remedy one, that you have nothing but what you've received, Christ being as well in fountain of common gifts as in saving grace. Now that's a helpful distinction. Have you ever noticed how intuitive something seems to be that you've been working on for a long time? It just comes naturally to you. It doesn't represent a difficulty anymore like it used to. And we can look at those problems and wonder, why don't other people get it? After all, it's obvious to us. Well, if you've learned something and mastered it well, it's easy to look down on contempt for those who have not conquered those same subjects. Now, we've got all kinds of teachers in the congregation. We've got those who serve in professional capacities and those who serve at home, those who serve in church, in lots of different ways that there are many teachers in here. And it is very helpful to remember that not everybody thinks this stuff isn't hard. Lots of people have struggles with the things that they learn. And it is a good thing for a teacher, for those who are learned and wise, to remember that Christ gives common grace as well as saving grace. He is the one that enables people to learn. We often forget that we were ignorant at once in this life, and that when we entered the world, we were only experts at one thing, and that was having a sinful nature. Everything that we've received is a gift of God. All right, it's easy then to differentiate the idea that Christ is the only one who can save us. And we can put saving grace in a special category of his work as opposed to common grace. Well, I think that's the wrong way to approach looking at the way Christ handles the various graces he gives to the world. It is true, and Ephesians 2:8 reminds us that salvation is a gift of God. It is a special grace that he bestows upon his people. But that doesn't mean that the common grace that men everywhere receive is not also a gift that God gives to the world. It is the goodness of God that sends rain on the just and the unjust. And therefore, those who are wise and learned should never have disdain for those who are ignorant. Brooks makes the assertion that common grace is a gift of God. If God has bestowed great wisdom or learning upon you, then bless his name for his goodness and treat it as the gift for which it is. The second remedy there, that men's learning and trusting in their own wits, parts, and abilities have been their utter overthrow and ruin. We won't look to all these scriptures, but I'll bring to mind that if you think great learning is your ticket out, be prepared that Satan looks at it as another opportunity, as another device that he can use to entangle your soul. You will not be saved by great learning. You will not be saved by great learning. Ahithophel, in Absalom's day, in 2 Samuel 15, I just put the references up there if anyone is interested. Did I put those references? Yeah, okay. And then Job's counselors are let's see, and Joab. I use those three examples. In 1 Kings 7, 2 Samuel 15, and Job are just three examples of people in the Scriptures who were bright and smart under ordinary circumstances, but they went the wrong direction. They paid steep prices. Ahithophel took his own life. Joab was eventually killed, and Job's counselors had to be prayed for by Job so that they could be reconciled to God for their misconduct. Okay, and I guess in closing, just to remind us that the wisest man who ever lived wrote in Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. You might be smart, and I thank God for that. But trust in the Lord and lean not on your understanding. The third remedy, that you do not transcend others more in parts and abilities than they do you in grace and holiness. Oftentimes, the measure of a man is how well he handles situations as you would. That's the measure that we often use. What would I have done in that situation? How would I have looked at that topic or thought about it? And if you're learned and wise in an area, it's easy to have disdain for those who work through those problems differently. What this means, in short, is that you become the measure of other men. You don't let other men stand before God in their own merits. You become the measure of other men because of the learning and the wisdom that you possess. It's easy, it's very easy for people to learn to compare themselves to others in areas where they're strong. We usually don't like to compare ourselves to others in areas where we are weak, but that's the point of this remedy, is to look that you may excel in one area and another man may excel in an area that is far more beneficial on an eternal basis. In fact, Brooks asks this very question: is it folly and madness in a man to make light and slight of another because he is not so rich in lead or iron as he, when he is 1,000,000 times richer in silver and gold and jewels and pearls than he? That's very helpful. In our day and age, we believe that education is all that is necessary to solve the plight of man. And I don't begrudge anyone's academic endeavors, but it doesn't matter how many degrees or how well educated you are if you're a fool. And it doesn't matter how much time you spend in learning or in university or in any other area to gain wisdom and expertise if you end up going to hell. It doesn't make any difference at all. Remedy four, that there is no such way for men to have their gifts and parts blasted and withered as to pride themselves in them, to rest upon them, to make light and slight of those that want them, and to engage them against persons, ways, and things that Jesus Christ has set his heart upon. If you want to be a prime target for temptation and a prime target for overthrow, learn to rest on your wisdom and learning. Learn to make that the basis and the measure of yourself. Because Satan will come and use you. He will tempt you and torment you. And God will set you up to fall. Proverbs 16:18 reminds us that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before the fall. Now, if you took great comfort at this last discourse, being something that is very powerful against them that are wise, you need not to rest so securely. Because in section 4, device 1, Brooks takes his aim at the people who believe that ignorance is the way of life. So if you think you can rest in your wisdom and your learning, you're gravely mistaken. If you think ignorance will save the day, you are also gravely mistaken. There is an old proverb that is popularly spoken of, and I don't know if you guys have heard it, but ignorance is bliss. Has everyone heard that phrase, that ignorance is bliss? And we usually use something like that when it's to our advantage. We rarely use it when it's to our loss. But did you know the quote actually reads, when ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise? Yeah. When wisdom is folly, then ignorance is bliss. So it's a sad state of affairs when we rest in the comfort of blissful ignorance. God has no pleasure in us remaining ignorant of his ways. Well, just how harmful is it? Well, ignorance is the mother of mistake, the cause of trouble, error, and of terror. It is the highway to hell, and it makes a man both a prisoner and a slave to the devil at once. Ignorance unmans a man. It makes man a beast. It makes him more miserable than the beast that perishes. There are none so easily nor so frequently taken in Satan's snares as ignorant souls. They are easily drawn to dance with the devil all day and dream of supping with Christ all night. These people are seriously deluded. Ignorance is the picture of an evil heart. That's the first remedy. And the second, that ignorance is the deformity of the soul. Proverbs 19:2 reads us, "It is not good for a soul to be without knowledge." It's not good for a soul to be without knowledge. Have you ever, maybe you guys have used the phrase before, but have you ever heard the phrase used when we see someone who is acting in a particularly distasteful or odious way? We might use the phrase, he's acting like an animal. Acting like, you look like an animal, you behave like an animal. Why would somebody say that about another individual? Well, it's because he's not demonstrating the characteristics of a person at the time. Isn't that right? He's acting like an animal. Well, Asaph in Psalm 73 uses those very words. He says in verse 22, I was so foolish and ignorant, I was like a beast before you. That's from Asaph, describing his own conduct as he looks at what ignorance did to him. It only stands to reason that if God gave us a soul and we're capable of learning and knowing, that it should behoove us to know and behave in ways that are pleasing to Him. To not do so is to show how debased we really are. Thirdly, that ignorance makes men the objects of God's hatred and wrath. The Scriptures portray ignorance and judgment together frequently. Romans 10:3 tells us, for they being ignorant of God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own righteousness, they have not submitted to the righteousness of God. We see God's judgment being displayed and manifested among the Jews here in Romans 10. Paul's telling them their ignorance is what keeps them in danger of judgment. Paul describes in 1 Timothy 1, verses 12 and 13, his pre-conversion conduct in this manner. And I thank Christ Jesus our Lord, who has enabled me, because He counted me faithful, putting me into the ministry, although I was formerly a blasphemer, persecutor, and an insolent man, but I obtained mercy because I did it ignorantly, in unbelief. Ignorance will drive a man to act in ways that are contrary to God's law. And finally, that ignorance is a sin that leads to all sins. In Matthew 22:29, Jesus takes the Sadducees to task because of their scriptural ignorance. He said to them, "You are mistaken, not knowing the Scriptures nor the power of God." He could have just as easily have said, "You are mistaken because you are ignorant of the Scriptures and ignorant of the power of God." They were learned, but they were not wise. They were clever, but their learning had not given them a new heart. Well, just how important is the goal of conquering ignorance in a Christian life? Well, if it wasn't so important, we wouldn't be in this class now, would we? That's exactly the reason we have this class. In fact, the capstone verse, if you'll think of it this way, is 2 Corinthians 2:11. Lest Satan should take advantage of us, for what? We are not ignorant of his devices. The whole goal of this class is to use what Walter Williams says, is to push back the frontiers of ignorance. It's the whole goal of this class, is to keep you from being ignorant of God's ways. Sin was at first the cause of ignorance, but now ignorance is the cause of all sin. Swearing and lying, killing, stealing, and whoring abound, said the prophet, because there is no knowledge of God in the land. There are none so frequent and so impudent in the ways of sin as ignorant souls. They care not, nor mind not what they do, nor what they say against God, Christ, heaven, holiness, and their own souls. Our tongues are our own. Who shall control us, they say? They are corrupt and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walks through the earth. Ignorance is a terrible condition to be in. And it is not bliss.